There are conditions that lead up to breaking these principles and falling down. But it's a fact that I think at least all the gurus in this movement that went wrong, they hadn't been keeping them up in some cases for a very long time. Okay?
It sounds that Prabhupada could not find out the way how to deal with sex desire. I mean, how to go through or over the Grihastha ashram. And how can we find out the way? And what is Krishna's plan behind this problem?
Prabhupada cannot find out. I don't know what you mean by that first part. You mean that Prabhupada was a Grihastha?
No.
For his disciples. We have a saying in English, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So Prabhupada actually gave us the method for overcoming sex desire. But we have to take it up. And I think from my accumulated wisdom, I guess, in being in this movement for some 20 years, it seems from my own experience and from talking to devotees, as far as sex desire goes, the real problem is deciding that you want to become free from sex desire. Once you make the decision, it can be done. But this is a decision people they get mental about all the time. You know, they just don't really want to make up their minds. So Prabhupada gave us the means for being free from sex desire. We have a condition passed in the West, the way most people are raised up. They're so much exposed to sex at such a very early age that it becomes difficult. The mind becomes the repository of all ideas of sense gratification. It becomes accustomed to sexual pleasure. And it just becomes very, very difficult with that kind of inertia to give it up. And I think at least that even though it may be difficult, that we can't lose sight of this goal. You know, there's been, people sometimes have discussions like, for example, in the Grihastha ashram, where my understanding as we took vows is that really in Grihastha ashram you don't have any sex unless you want to have children, then you chant 50 rounds, want no more than once a month. If you're not trying to have children, there's no sex. I've heard people claim, well, that's the highest standard, but actually, you know, if it's your wife and it's not adultery, then it's all right, you know. And they want to find some kind of law where, you know, technically I'm not disobeying the order. The point is this, that it's not a question of, you know, what is the rule or what is not the rule. It's a simple fact of life that if we are engaged in any sense gratification, and most especially sex life, for fun, you know, for anything but the procreation of children, if we're doing it for anything but that, under the right conditions, then it is not possible to even understand you're not your body. At the very first level of our philosophy is, I am not my body. And there's nothing that forces us to identify with the body more deeply and more thoroughly than sex. It cannot be done that a person engages in sex life and then has any realization, I'm not my body. You have to identify yourself with the material body. So that means is if under, whether we think it's license or not, that if we engage in sex life, our spiritual advancement stops. It just comes to an end. We won't go anywhere. We'll be standing in one place. Or, you know, minuscule progress, you know, hardly visible. When we give it up, then everything starts to move. So it's a question, really, of what you want in life. But so the price that we have to pay for sex indulgence is birth and death in the material world. That's just the law of nature. You can make up whatever rules you want. This remains the law of nature. So we have to decide, why are we in the Hare Krishna movement? We're in the Hare Krishna movement, I think, because we want to become free, at least, from birth and death in the material world. Therefore, we have to have a commitment toward becoming free from sex desire. So it's a fact, you see. When you become a devotee of Krishna, your life becomes very hard. Because you're divided against yourself. You want one thing, you want to be a devotee, and your mind wants something else. So you're not at whole with yourself. You know, sometimes you meet materialists, they're all at one, you know. They're flowing with it. They say, devotees are so uptight, they're tense, you can see they're rigid, you know. Well, they've just surrendered to their material desires, that's all. And we are engaging in a struggle. We are going to try to defeat Maya by overcoming the sex desire. So that's that issue of sex is not something off to the side. It's the central issue. I mean, if I said earlier the enemies are lust, greed, and anger, well, both greed and anger come from lust anyway, so it's lust. It is lust only, Krishna says. So that's really our battle. And this is where the Krishna Consciousness Movement, if it has anything unique to offer, we can offer any religion anything higher, is because we, first of all, can take on, and we can take on with success, the enemy known as lust. That's really our business. So it turned out to be not so easy. When Prabhupada came to America, he said Krishna consciousness was easy. Well, maybe it's a mistake telling Americans anything is easy, because what they mean by easy is it's instant, it's right there. So maybe it's not so easy as we all thought. But it's easy if you compare it to Jnana Yoga or Raja Yoga. Easy compared to any other bona fide process. Maybe it's not easier than cheating. But that's our business. So there, this is, Prabhupada says, you know, we have declared war against Maya. And so every one of us is a warrior. And we're fighting this big battle, which is the most heroic battle that there is. No one else in the world is fighting this fight, or very few other people are actually fighting this fight. And that's our fight. And that there have been casualties, some fairly prominent casualties, that you're going to have to expect that. We become discouraged, especially when we see big stalwart devotees, or what appear to be big stalwart devotees, fall down. We think, well, if they can't do it, how can I? But anyway, learn from whatever mistakes were there, and keep on going. And I don't think of anyone as permanently lost, at any rate. You'll see in the long run that every minute that one spends in this war against the material energy to transcend the material world is well worth it. Even if there's some slip or there's some fall down, I'm convinced all these people, they'll be back. They won't give up. You can't, probably, this is what Krishna says. When the devatas pray to Krishna in the womb, they say that, you know, all these big mayavadis who go up and attain parampadam, or at least think they have the highest abode, still they fall down again. But a devotee, even if he falls down, he never undergoes the ordinary course of material karma. Because he can't forget Krishna, and Krishna never forgets him. So I think if you'll take the long view, I think you'll see there's nothing really to be discouraged about, and that we will be able to keep on going. Prabhupada gave us everything we need to do, and it's time to understand, oh, it's a little harder than we thought. It's not so easy. So now I have to become stronger, and I have to be more careful and more staunch in my Krishna consciousness that we are going to do what we're supposed to do. Okay?
I think the analysis you've given is very good so far, especially with regard to, as devotees, how we can perceive these things. My question is just on a bit of a different track, because as devotees, we're confronted sometimes with these things. I remember the very first time I realized, you know, there could be anything scandalous could happen in ISKCON. I became a devotee in Ireland, and you know, we were all just brahmacharis, and we hadn't got a clue about anything except books. I was on the street distributing books, and it was 1980, and what happened with Hansaduda in Berkeley had just been revealed to the press, and it hit the Irish press, but of course we didn't read newspapers. So this fellow came up and started to say, you know, Hansaduda? And I said, Hansaduda, Srila Hansaduda Swami, the pure devotee. And I, you know, and I practically paid my obeisances on the spot. And he said, well, and he started telling me about gun smuggling and shooting at grapevines from the temple to houses across the street, and, you know, all kinds of crazy fraud and stealing credit cards. And I stood there with my mouth open, and I didn't know what to say, because I didn't, well, number one, I didn't know the facts. Mm-hmm. But as well as that, you know, even if I at that time understood, okay, we're a young movement, we've got a long way to go, we're young people, you know, the devotee that made me devotee, he was a hippie, and maybe now I'm a cheat, and I don't know, you know, somebody, I could have sociologically sussed the whole thing on the spot, which I didn't, but even if I did that, how do I relate to him, who doesn't understand anything about Krishna consciousness in the ultimate issue? How can I relate to him,
Yeah. So this is how dealing with the outside people. There's several people we have to deal with in the outside on this matter. Three different groups. One, the press. Two, your parents and relatives. And three, academics. You know, the people you know, the press people, academic people. Academic people are probably the easiest because they all know the history of religions anyway. And to them, this is standard operating procedure. The kind of thing happens all the time, everywhere. As far as what happens in with Hamsatuda, I mean, I think you can understand that people go wrong, that there are people who deviate from the standards. What we had to do in the wake of Hamsaduda and people like that, and what we had to respond to, that ISKCON had to respond to as an institution, is to be a little better at self-correcting. Everybody will understand, press, parents, academics, that people can fail, that they can go wrong, they can fall down, that they can deviate. That in itself is not enough to condemn an institution. The institution is in trouble if it can't, it doesn't have a mechanism for safeguarding itself against those people and be self-correcting. And that's what ISKCON is set up to do, is to be self-correcting. There were people at one time who thought that, especially if they were initiating gurus, that they were above the authority of the GBC. That's not the case. And in his first line of his will, where an acharya of an institution will appoint a successor, Prabhupada said that the ultimate managing authority for the entire International Society for Krishna Consciousness is the Governing Body Commission. That remains the ultimate managing authority, and that ability of the GBC and power of the GBC to deal with anyone has been well established, because in dealing with Hamsaduda, the GBC was somewhat tardy. And because there was propaganda from the other side, the GBC had no right to do this. It took the GBC a while. It kind of didn't know how to do with it. So it's become more responsive and responsible. So that's the one point, is that it can be seen that ISKCON is a self-correcting body, that it can recognize when people go wrong and it can deal with them, and that has been doing. I think that ISKCON's also become a little better at explaining these things to its own members. So you don't get totally surprised when something happens and some reporter comes up to you and tells you some story you don't know what to believe. And so we're also set up now to explain these things to devotees. Sometimes when things go wrong and there's a scandal or some difficulty, there's a process called denial. The way you would deal with it is just pretend it didn't happen. You lie to yourself about it, and you lie to others. And this is what I think you mentioned. When somebody sees it, like an authority or a spiritual master, somebody's going off, or what happened in New York with Bali Mardan, for a long time people just denied it. Or they found some rationalization, or they convinced themselves that they must be crazy. And these kind of mechanisms are there. So if we get a little more healthy about this, we'll understand that these things can happen. We'll recognize them and try to respond to them. But we've also discovered when the New Vrindavan thing broke, the policy of New Vrindavan to the press was just to deny everything. Across the board, say that everything that was being said was a lie. We had the spectacle in the United States of Kirtananda talking to reporters, and they're saying, what about all the deaths that have been taking place in New Vrindavan, all the bodies they buried? He says, there are no deaths, there are no bodies. These are lies that are being spread by our enemies. There are no bodies. Cut to, skulls being pulled out of the ground. I must have seen Chakradhara's skull come out in slow motion, 1,000 times, and all the, with Bhaktipada's voice overlaying, saying there's no such thing. This just doesn't work. It really makes you look like a criminal when you lie like that. So it's a good idea to tell the truth, and to recognize the truth, and to do what you can to correct things. And I think we've come to understand that in our movement. Okay, anything more you want to? Yeah, anyone else? Yeah? You're holding the mic. You might as well put it to your mouth.
It's a question that just kind of like responding to a number of things that you have said. I've traveled a lot, and I've seen some places in our movement, not here in Europe so much, but maybe I should just say my trips to Australia. Uh-huh. And I've heard, I sometimes hear that some parts of America are like this too. You might say there's sort of a steady state of scandalous activity in our movement, low key perhaps, but uh-huh. As you mentioned, when you first joined the movement and you had high ideals, and then you looked around you and you were shocked. And it seems like, I would say, considerable, I don't want to give percentage, but a significant number of devotees in our who are acting in our movement, known as devotees, have kind of become accustomed, inured or whatever, to scandalous activity of different sorts, breaking the principles. Mm-hmm.
Scandalous by our standards.
Yes.
Not enough to get you thrown in jail.
Right. Uh-huh. And but this affects the consciousness of whole temples, whole zones, and affects the preaching too, because this becomes known by the outsiders, and they also lower their expectations and their own level of how much they're going to commit themselves personally to Krishna consciousness. So you get, you. I made the comment the last time I was in King's Cross Temple. I said, you know, because King's Cross is that scandalous area. And in a Bhagavatam class, I closed it by this statement after some questions. I said, well, personally, I can't really, I wouldn't be able to say where King's Cross ends and the temple begins. Mm-hmm. So, and everyone kind of like nodded in a sense. So I wondered, I wondered if you could just comment on what we should do about that. Because out of such an environment, I think big scandals could arise mm-hmm. very easily. They do. Mm-hmm. And how should we deal with this?
This in these places that it's happening, at least I've seen in America, a lot of times, you know, this has been a reaction to the previous fall down of a big guru, and everybody's become so discouraged by it and about it that they really have given themselves over to kind of continuous low-level scandalous activities. So I know what you're talking about. It's really time in these cases, I think way past time, for a little more honest assessment, first of all, of what's going on, and some concerted plan of action to change things. What you need, I would think, in these kinds of circumstances, where it's become part of the local culture, it becomes very difficult even for a single GBC to deal with. GBCs, unless they really live there, they come and go, and everybody, you know, a GBC comes in, there's people at Mangalarti, the GBC leaves, and then there are more deities at Mangalarti than there are devotees, you know. This is known to happen in many, many cases. So when things have become dispirited like this, I think that's the correct word, is they're really dispirited, you know. Really there has to be some kind of effort of having some outside preachers who are correctly situated come and stay there and spend some time, because really what it is, there's an absence of good association. People don't have good association. And the next thing that has to happen is all televisions have to be destroyed. Televisions are, in these places, the biggest enemies for the Hare Krishna movement. Because people watch them at night. They're busy during the day, they work or they do some service, and they come home at night and they watch them. Now sometimes what they watch, you know, at least this is my experience in interviewing television watchers, they claim that they only watch nature shows, you know. There's a show about dingoes or caribou. They're educational nature shows. I don't always believe this. But even if it's so, what they do is they stay up late at night. They stay up till 10, 10:30. So they don't go to Mangalarti. They don't have a morning program. And I've told Nisringananda of ITV that I think that that actually we never had any televisions until we got ITV. And then everybody had an excuse. Not only get a television, but what is infinitely worse, a video player.